Chapter 58. A List of Grievances. RAN is just one of many organizations demonstrating that corporations are vulnerable, that they can and will change. Subsequent chapters will describe the successful methods of a number of these NGOs. They have forced the giants of industry to clean up polluted rivers, outlaw ozone layer-destroying aerosol sprays, protect endangered species, opened their doors to minorities, ban gender discrimination, and implement a wide range of other policies that address social, environmental, civil rights, and humanitarian issues. Similar approaches can be applied to changing the fundamental goals of corporations, to transforming them into good planetary citizens who serve the interests of societies and environments, rather than those of a tiny global aristocracy. Following extensive discussions and research, I concluded that change is possible. It is happening in very significant ways. Corporations are bending to our will. We have the power to achieve monumental changes in the way our society is structured. Now the second question. Are we certain that we want change? In Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa, we have seen the terrible consequences of the EHMs, jackals, and the final solution of the military, even as the colonists witnessed the inequities and suffering caused by British policies. We ask ourselves whether these are enough to motivate us to take the necessary actions. Prior to the revolution, journalists like Benjamin Franklin, orators like Patrick Henry, and pamphleteers like Tom Paine understood the importance of succinctly defining the injustices perpetrated by the Crown. There was simply no substitute for the presentation of ironclad reasons, data, and statistics. Their arguments resulted in a long list of grievances against the British monarchy that ultimately was summarized in the Declaration of Independence. It served as a motivator, as well as rationale, for taking action. Today we have an even longer list of grievances against the corporatocracy. It is presented to us regularly by the press, often inadvertently, over the internet and in films and books. A summary of salient points. Because of corporatocracy policies and actions. More than half the world's population survives on less than $2 a day, about the same real income as they had 30 years ago. More than 2 billion people lack access to basic amenities, including electricity, clean water, sanitation, land titles, phones, police, and fire protection. There is a 55-60% failure rate for all World Bank-sponsored projects, according to a study by the Joint Economic Committee of U.S. Congress. The cost of servicing third world debt is greater than all third world spending on health or education, and nearly 2 times the amount those countries receive each year in foreign aid. Despite current lip service to forgiving it, third world debt grows every year, currently approaching $3 trillion. The record is not encouraging. During the 1996 round of debt forgiveness, the G7 countries, IMF and World Bank, announced a cancellation of up to 80% in HIPC, heavily indebted poor countries, debt. But between 1996 and 1999, the overall amount of debt servicing payments from HIPC actually increased by 25%, from $88.6 trillion to $114.4 trillion. A trade surplus of $1 billion for developing countries in the 1970s turned into an $11 billion deficit at the beginning of the new millennium and continues to grow. Ownership of third world wealth is more concentrated than it was before the 1970s era of massive infrastructure development and the 1990s privatization wave. In many countries, the top 1% of households now accounts for more than 90% of all private wealth. Transnational corporations have taken control over much of the production and commerce in developing countries. For example, 40% of the world's coffee is traded by just 4 companies, while 30 supermarket chains account for almost 1/3 of worldwide grocery sales. A handful of oil and other resource extractive companies control not only the markets, but also the governments of countries that possess the resources. Corporate greed was highlighted when ExxonMobil announced another record-breaking profit, $10.4 billion, in the second quarter of 2006, the second biggest profit ever reported by a U.S. company, surpassed only by Exxon's $10.7 billion in the fourth quarter of 2005. Both were years when rising oil prices caused intense suffering among the world's poor. Oil companies are highly subsidized through tax breaks, trade agreements, and international environmental and labor laws that favor them. The overall share of federal taxes paid by U.S. corporations is now less than 10%, down from 21% in 2001, and more than 50% during World War II. One-third of America's largest and most profitable corporations paid zero taxes in at least one of the first 3 years in the new millennium. In 2002, U.S. corporations booked $149 billion in tax haven countries such as Ireland, Bermuda, Luxembourg, and Singapore. Of the 100 largest economies in the world, 51 are corporations. Of these, 47 are U.S.-based. At least 34,000 children under 5 years old die every day from hunger or preventable diseases. The United States and many of the countries Washington touts as democracies exhibit the following undemocratic characteristics. The media is manipulated by huge corporations and the government. Politicians are beholden to wealthy campaign contributors. And policies made behind closed doors ensure that voters are not informed about key issues. When the International Treaty to Ban Landmines was passed by the UN in 1997 by a vote of 142-0, the United States abstained. The United States refused to ratify the 1989 Convention on the Rights of the Child, the International Biological Weapons Convention, the Kyoto Protocol, and an International Criminal Court. Global military spending reached a new record high of $1.1 trillion in 2006, with the United States accounting for nearly half of that, averaging $1,600 for every U.S. man, woman, and child. The United States was ranked number 53 on the World Press Freedom List in 2006, compared to number 17 in 2002, and has been severely criticized by Reporters Without Borders and other NGOs for jailing and intimidating journalists. The U.S. national debt, amount of money owed by the U.S. federal government to creditors who hold U.S. debt instruments, the largest in the world, reached $8.5 trillion in August 2006, or $28,500 for every U.S. citizen. It was increasing by $1.7 billion a day. A large percentage of this debt is held by the central banks of Japan and China, and by members of the EU, rendering us extremely vulnerable to them. U.S. external debt, total public and private debt, owed to non-residents repayable in foreign currency, goods, or services, is also the largest in the world, estimated at $9 trillion in 2005. It is noteworthy that Washington uses the national and external debts of other countries as weapons, forcing their governments to comply with corporatocracy demands or face bankruptcy, economic sanctions, and severe IMF-imposed conditionalities. Yet the United States is the largest debtor nation in the world. This partial list leaves no doubt that we must use the tools at our disposal to effect change. These grievances serve as our motivator, as well as our rationale, for altering the abominable reality of the world the corporatocracy has created. At the heart of every one of the inequities are corporations. By changing them, we will change the world. We must insist that corporations become democratic and transparent. No longer will we accept imperialistic capitalism, where a very few rich men make all the decisions and most of the money and do so largely in secret. We will demand that they abide by those principles we hold to be self-evident, as stated in our most sacred documents, principles of justice, equality, compassion, and governance with an eye toward providing peace and stability for future generations. We will recognize that we live in a tiny global community, and that corporations must set new goals that reflect this reality. Rather than accumulating wealth for the few, they must take care of their employees, even after retirement, serve their customers, look after those who supply the resources they use, who mine, plant, pick, weave, smelt, process, fashion, shape, and assemble. And they must protect the communities and environments where all these people live. This process also requires that we honor the nurturing aspects of ourselves, those associated with the feminine, and reject the idea that this is a man's world, where might is right. Rion Eisler, author of the national bestseller The Chalice and the Blade, joined a number of researchers in analyzing measures that compare the status of women with those relating to the quality of life. Relying on statistics gathered by 89 nations, their study concluded that the status of women is a better predictor of the general quality of life than its gross domestic product. In her new book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Dr. Eisler reports, "In societies where women have higher status and are almost half the government, such as the Nordic nations, more fiscal priority is given to caring policies such as universal health care, high-quality child care, parenting education, and generous paid parental leave. When the status and power of women is higher, so also is a nation's general quality of life, and when it's lower, so is the quality of life for all. We must understand that our very survival depends upon our ability to be compassionate. We must nurture. We must embrace and love. Our tiny planet is, like the Titanic, sinking rapidly. Unlike the Titanic, it does not have too few lifeboats. It has no lifeboats. Our most powerful institutions, our corporations, need to operate the pumps. They ran the boat into the iceberg. Now they have to bail it out and set a new course. And we the people must do the right thing, the rational and pragmatic thing. We must make ourselves heard. We must demand that the corporations become democratic and transparent. Before addressing the issues dealing with unifying principles and what we each can do, the actions we can take individually and communally, it is important to address an obstacle that halts many of us from ever asking those questions. I came face to face with this obstacle while attending a conference on an island in the Atlantic. I discovered just how effective the corporatocracy has been in silencing its opposition, at striking fear into some of the very organizations that are in the best positions to change it. Chapter 59. Facing Our Fears. During that period in 2006, when I was exploring the impacts of NGOs on corporations, I joined a group of 23 men and women on the island of Martha's Vineyard for several days of meetings. The discussions were echoes, I believe, of debates that raged in the colonies during the years leading up to the revolution. Many colonists were terrified of the British. Along with the Loyalists, or Tories, they opposed taking action. "The British Empire is just too big, too powerful," they warned. "We'll lose and be persecuted for defying it." The setting for those 2006 meetings off the coast of Massachusetts was auspicious, a sort of microcosm for today's larger world. The vineyard was once home to a large whaling fleet and became the 18th century's equivalent to the current Middle East and Amazon, a primary source of oil for American industries and homes. Like deserts and rainforests today, whale populations back then were devastated. The discovery of petroleum in nearby Pennsylvania offered a cheaper alternative and led to the collapse of the whale oil industry. In more recent years, this island gained a reputation as a playground for the famous. The Kennedy and Clinton families, actors, writers, and musicians. It served as location filming for the movie Jaws. By the time I arrived in 2006, it also reflected the ecological imbalance so common in our world. Overpopulated by deer, it became overrun by the dreaded Lyme disease-carrying deer ticks. I was told that many residents had contracted the illness. As a result, we were warned not to stroll through the lush grasslands or enchanted forests. Best to view them from the safety of an air-conditioned car. Most of the 23 conferees represented nonprofits that received donations from our host, a wealthy philanthropist. They were dedicated to protecting the environment, endangered species, human rights, and issues around gender and health. On a number of occasions, I appealed to the participants to devote some of their efforts to bringing corporations around using RAN as an example. I was shocked at the responses. Executives can't be trusted. We stay away from the corporate world. Too corrupting. Too powerful. We'll lose and be punished. Extremely dangerous. Better not to take the risk. Look, I said, every one of you is involved in important work. But in a way, you're applying band-aids. We're hemorrhaging badly, so we need band-aids. But unless we start curing the disease, the underlying cause, all the band-aids in the world won't save us. Your right to protect yourselves against corruption by corporations, but for heaven's sake, deal with them. Map out a strategy. Mona Cadena, Deputy Director, Western Region for Amnesty International, spoke up. We at Amnesty agree. With over 1.8 million members in about 150 countries, we know the power of corporations. In fact, we buy stock in some of the worst offenders. Enough so we can attend meetings and file shareholder resolutions requiring the companies to adopt human rights policies in every country where they work. Mona's willingness to speak out gave me heart. Later, as we sat at a window overlooking a huge brackish lake separated from the Atlantic Ocean by a tiny sandbar, Mona talked about Tony Cruz, Amnesty's corporate action network coordinator in California. He had engaged Google co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and Yahoo CEO Terry Semel and founder Jerry Yang in face-to-face exchanges at stockholder meetings, insisting that those companies stop aiding repression of free speech in China. In addition, more than 40,000 activists participated in online actions targeting the companies. We haven't yet got either of them to take proactive stances, Mona sighed. But we did write an article in Business Week and airtime on some ABC stations. We know it's worth the effort. Pressure brings results. RAN's done a great job. Milo Rosenthal, director of the Business and Human Rights Program at Amnesty, told me over the phone when I contacted her several days later. Their work is very challenging. They have to force management to accept specific restrictions on logging. You might think that our approach, using shareholder resolutions, would be easier, and that companies would see that commitments to respect human rights will benefit everyone, but still we get a lot of resistance. ExxonMobil is a case in point. The oil giant, the largest energy company on the planet, has accumulated a record of human rights abuses in many countries. Amnesty zeroed in on Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, and Indonesia. We saw how adamantly ExxonMobil resisted efforts to get them to clean up their act, Mila continued. We had our members deluge their CEO with postcards. We organized vigils, teach-ins, and protests. On Valentine's Day, we sent cards asking them to have a heart for human rights. We formed coalitions with other like-minded shareholders. Together with the AFL-CIO, the Teachers Retirement System of New York City, Boston Common Asset Management, Allied Industrial, Chemical and Energy Workers International Union, PACE, the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, and Walden Asset Management, they called on ExxonMobil to adopt and implement a company-wide workplace human rights policy based on the 1998 International Labor Organization's Declaration of Fundamental Principles of Rights at Work, ILO Declaration, and prepare a report available to shareholders concerning implementation of this policy. After filing this resolution, the coalition met with corporate officials. ExxonMobil agreed to include a statement supporting the ILO declaration in its corporate citizenship report. At the 2004 annual shareholders meeting, Chip Pitts, then chair of the board of Amnesty International, warned that coalition members would hold the company responsible for its promises. We didn't get everything we wanted, Mila admitted to me, but we've made a good start. Our organizations learned a great deal. We will change these guys. one company at a time. The meeting on Martha's Vineyard at first frustrated me because so many there had succumbed to corporate intimidation. Yet I also developed a greater appreciation for Amnesty and the other organizations that, like those Americans at Bunker Hill, are facing their fears. By standing up to the corporations, they inspire all of us. I knew that hearing Mona speak out must have convinced one or two of the Tories to take heart.